Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
I'm Karen Given, filling in this week for Bill Littlefield. Every once in a while, Bill goes on vacation, and when he does, we get a chance to pick books off the shelf that Bill might not choose. Bill's not a big fan of football's more violent side, nor is he a big fan of Teddy Roosevelt. So John J. Miller's new book, The Big Scrum, How Teddy Roosevelt Saved Football, seemed like the logical choice for this week's show. Miller's book is set at the turn of the century, when football was claiming more than a dozen lives a year. The fate of the game was precarious, as universities were dropping the sport and state legislators were moving to ban it. When I spoke with Miller, I asked him to describe the game of football as it was played in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and to explain why so many people wanted to ban the sport.
In 1905, 18 people died playing football. They were on the big-time college level all the way down to the sandlot level. So 18 people died playing football. We hear a lot about violence in football today with concussions and the long-term health effects of head injuries and so forth. But they were dropping dead a dozen or more a year back in those days. And that's because, in large measure, the sport was different from how it is now. It was a lot more like rugby back in the early days. Think of it as a series of goal line stands on the 50-yard line over and over and over again. Big men crashing into each other, forming piles. And it was a brutal sport. It was so brutal that broken bones were common. And then there were these deaths. And the problem was severe enough that a prohibition movement rose up. A group of people led by the president of Harvard University, who was Charles W. Eliot at the time, The Nation magazine, muckraking journalists. They said it was a blood sport. They compared it to gladiatorial combat in the Roman amphitheater. They said, there's no place for this in modern American life. We must prohibit the sport. So they crusaded against it, and it took Theodore Roosevelt to save the game.
So let's get to that. Theodore Roosevelt was arguably football's most influential supporter, and Harvard President Charles Eliot was one of football's greatest detractors. They were both proponents of a movement called muscular Christianity. What was muscular Christianity?
So in the middle of the 19th century, a lot of Americans were concerned about the fitness of their country. Were people getting enough exercise? People were moving from the countryside into the city. They were taking jobs in factories. Life, in a lot of ways, was becoming more sedentary. In the middle of the 19th century, people said, we've got to do something about this. And so a social and religious movement rose up called muscular Christianity that says, to be a good Christian, you need to take care of not only your soul, but also your body. And the most obvious manifestation of it that we still know about today is the YMCA movement, and you know, the Young Men's Christian Association, which became famous for its gymnasiums. And this was an aspect of muscular Christianity. This is sort of the social, political, and religious context into which these games are born.
So how did these two men, Roosevelt and Eliot, interpret this so differently?
Well, Roosevelt attended Harvard University, and in 1876, as an 18-year-old freshman, he watched his first football game. He and a bunch of friends got on a train in Cambridge and went down to New Haven. They watched the second ever football game played between Harvard and Yale. He thinks this is great entertainment. It's great fun to watch. Over time, he becomes convinced that football and rough sports like it are socially useful. They're socially useful because they help turn boys into men, and they help make them into men who can lead America forward into a new century. And he's become such an advocate of this idea that when he recruits the Rough Riders, we all know the story. He goes out to San Antonio and wants to recruit a bunch of cowboys and Westerners to be in this unit that's going to fight with him in Cuba. And that's basically true. But if you read his memoirs, he also says he wants football players. And he signs them up. They go to Cuba with him. So he saw football as not just a piece of mere entertainment, but actually a social good. Charles Eliot, on the other hand, most important man in the history of higher education in the United States. He's the one who made Harvard a great school. He was president for 40 years, longer than anybody before or since. He believed in physical fitness. He believed in exercise. He engaged in a lot of it himself. But he did not like football. He did not like the violence. He thought it was an ungentlemanly sport and had no place in modern American life. So he and Roosevelt started butting heads.
Well, what I love about his objections to the sport are so crazy. He equated coaching from the sidelines with cheating, and he thought that feigning a pass was somehow immoral. Have I got that right?
Yeah, it is. It's funny to read him today on this. He didn't like baseball either. He thought if a pitcher threw a curveball, he was engaging in an act of deception, and that's something that gentlemen shouldn't do. He also thought that games that required umpires and referees were unfit for gentlemen, because gentlemen shouldn't require these kinds of arbiters on the field. They should be able to settle their own differences and be sportsmanlike and so on. And it sounds crazy today, but you got to recognize that these sports were just being born back then, and you know, they were making up the rules as they went along, and these were some attitudes that Eliot brought to the sport. Now, when he starts criticizing football's brutality, you got to confess that he kind of has a point. People are getting hurt, some are dying, and he wanted to do something about that.
So Harvard banned football in 1885, but the sport was brought back just a year later when the athletic committee ruled that the game of football has been much improved during the past season. The game hadn't been improved at all, so why did Harvard bring it back?
Well, the sport was becoming more and more popular. Students loved it. Alumni loved it. It was popular in the press. Sports sections and newspapers were being born at this time, and they loved to cover football, you know, then as they do now. And alumni pressure forced the game to come back after a one-year hiatus at Harvard. And there was some concern that Harvard was not keeping up with Yale and Princeton, which never did abandon the sport. And there were also people who said, well, you know, the reason Harvard gave it up is because Yale was actually beating them year after year. So people were poked fun at Harvard for having given it up. But they were only gone for a year, and then they came back and kept on playing. But the violence continued.
Well, since the early days of football, the game had caused serious injury and even death. So what was it about the death of Georgia's Richard von Gammon in 1897 that captured the attention of those trying to ban the sport?
Richard von Gammon was a running back for the team, and he was killed during a game. As a result, there was this public outcry in Georgia saying, this is too violent, we can't have our kids dropping dead on the gridiron. So the Georgia legislature passed legislation to outlaw football, and the bill got to the desk of the governor, and the governor was getting ready to sign it. It's hard to imagine football outlawed in Georgia, but there they were, the governor's ready to sign it. And then the mother of Richard von Gammon said, wait a second, my son loved football. And I don't want his legacy to be getting rid of the sport. So she pleaded with the governor, please, please keep the sport. Don't use the death of my son to outlaw it. It's a good sport. We don't need to get rid of it. And she's a feisty old lady. I learned that there was a moment when she had this big tree in her front yard, and a telephone company, I think it was, wanted to come cut it down so they could put a line through or something like that. And she didn't want her tree cut down, so she went out there with her shotgun and sat beneath the tree and just sort of stared down the people who came to cut it down. She won that battle. Her tree remains. So that gives you a sense of what Mrs. von Gammon was like. But she pleaded with the governor to preserve the sport, and he ultimately agreed with her, and he did not sign the bill, and football remained in Georgia. But this is the type of thing that was going on, and players were dying at big time college programs, and it was under a lot of pressure to change, and there was this threat of prohibition always there.
So President Roosevelt's agenda in the summer and fall of 1905 went something like this. Negotiate a peace accord between Japan and Russia, and then get the top men in football together and save the game.
Exactly.
Did Roosevelt really do anything more than say, gentlemen, fix this?
That is what he did, but of course it mattered a lot. Now, he was a frenetically busy president, and in that summer, as you say, he was negotiating peace between Russia and Japan, and those efforts would lead to his receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. He was the first American to receive it, and it was for those negotiations. And as that was winding down, he received a letter from a friend of his who said, you know, you might be able to help with this football problem. And in October of 1905, Roosevelt summons to the White House the head coaches from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, the three biggest and most important college football programs at the time. The guy from Yale was Walter Camp, the legendary founding father of football, whose name, he's sort of the Abner Doubleday of football, you might say. Anyway, Roosevelt invites these guys to the White House. They have conversations about some of the problems and potential solutions and so forth, but Roosevelt didn't issue any orders. He didn't tell them what to do, but he said something has to be done. And so they passed a series of sweeping rule changes, the most important of which is the development of the forward pass. John Heisman, another name that sort of echoes to us today, was an advocate of the forward pass. Walter Camp always resisted it, and he was even resisting it up to the bitter end. But they approved the forward pass, and in doing so, they began to address the violence problem, number one. And number two, they created football as a distinctively American sport. This was the moment when it really separated itself from its origins as a rugby game. And of course, it wanted to become what is today by far the most popular sport in the United States.
You mentioned Walter Camp, and he was, of course, instrumental in the early development and success of the game. Why was he so resistant to change?
Walter Camp was an incredibly important figure, probably the most important figure in the development of the game. He was a player in that 1876 game that Roosevelt watched. He played for the Yale team. Camp became very involved in the rules committee that oversaw football and the standardization of it. So he started inventing the sport, basically, and he invented the rule of possession. He invented the position of quarterback, all kinds of things. When his career as a player was over, he became a coach at Yale, and then he was on this rules committee. Well, by the time 1905 rolled around, Camp was quite satisfied with this sport that he had created. He thought it was a good sport. He saw that it was popular. He didn't see any problem with it at all. So he resisted this radical change, the forward pass. He thought it would change the game fundamentally. I mean, he was right about that, but he was wrong, I think, about its value. It was passed over his objection, and it probably is responsible for the popularity that football went on to enjoy.
Even with these rules, football will never be entirely safe. I suspect that Teddy Roosevelt would be pleased about that.
Roosevelt understood that it was a rough sport. He also understood that there's no such thing as a risk-free activity. He believed that rough sports like football were good for boys, taught them how to deal with adversity, thought a boy getting banged up on a football field and feeling a little sore the next day was probably good for his character, and he thought it helped turn them into great Americans who could lead the country forward.
I really can't resist a what if here. If Roosevelt was alive and president today, what would he say to the NFL owners and players to resolve the current labor impasse?
That's a great question. I think as a general rule, we don't want our politicians getting involved in our sports. Like the only thing that could make the bowl championship series even worse is congressional involvement, right? I mean, just stay away, please. Don't go anywhere near it, right? On the other hand, what we know now about Roosevelt and what he did in 1905 shows that a skillful leader with a deft touch can solve a vexing problem. And, you know, I would welcome the president today taking a couple hours out of his day and solving the lockout. That would be a great use of his time. I don't know that it could be done, but Roosevelt took on a very serious problem back in 1905, and through his intervention, the sport came up with a solution.
John J. Miller's new book, The Big Scrum, is published by Harper. He joined me from NPR in Washington. John, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks very much.
My conversation with John J. Miller, author of The Big Scrum, will be included in this week's program. I'll also visit with some amateur greyhound racers who run for nothing more than belly rubs and sheer joy. Only a Game's Doug Trabu will be on hand to ask what Seattle Supersonics fans think now that their team is thriving on the court in Oklahoma City. And NBA.com's Steve Ashburner joins me to break down the conference finals. Also, Tim Kirkjian on baseball and Charlie Pierce on everything else. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.